The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, it's the day after Budget Day. It used to be a big set piece politically, not so much these days, but still important in the political calendar. And I'm joined by Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. You're very welcome to the programme.
Good morning, and great to see you in person again.
It's been a while.
Lovely to see you.
Looking at the budget, I mean, you could be accused of tinkering around the edges. You know, there's a bit for childcare, a bit for SNAs, pensions, cut price public transport for younger people, a bit on housing, a bit on rents. But no big idea.
Well, I think there are four big ideas. The first is getting the public finances back in order. Next year, we'll only be borrowing for capital, only borrowing to invest, which is a good place to be in terms of managing the public finances. Within a year or so, we'll be delivering balanced budgets again. So that's the most important thing, because at the moment, governments can borrow at 0%. That's going to change. Interest rates are going to go up, and we need to make sure we got the public finances back in order before that. There's help with the cost of living, which is really important given what families are facing in terms of the rising cost of living. There's a lifeline for businesses that are still struggling. And there's huge investment in public services, the Department of Health keeping that €22 billion. So I think they're the big ideas.
At the same time, people will talk about childcare. And, you know, sometimes in a department, for example, when Michael Noonan was in health, he concentrated on cancer. But childcare seems to be a big bugbear for many people in the middle generation.
Yeah.
And the estimates to do it by the state exclusively would cost close to €3 billion a year. So that's what people would love. They look to Scandinavia and all theirs. Why can't we do it here? That can't be done without massive hikes in tax.
I think it would be hard to do without some sort of increase in tax or USC or PRSI. In this budget, there were two moves on childcare, if you like. The childcare subsidy is going to be paid in respect to all children up to the age of 15 from next September, and that'll help families with the cost of childcare. There'll be a freeze in childcare fees, and crucially, and this is something Minister Gorman wanted to concentrate on for the year coming, there'll be an improvement in terms and conditions for staff under what's called a JLC and an ERO, which we run by my department. So there'll be a new set of minimum standards in terms of pay, terms and conditions for staff.
But the sector is screaming.
And capacity in the sector, which is the most important thing.
They're not that pleased, though, are they? Because they're saying, you know, we can't, if we get the money from the state, we can't put up our prices, and we really might need to do.
I think the most important thing for the year coming is to put in place that minimum set of terms and conditions for staff, to pay them better, and that will help us to recruit and increase capacity in childcare, which is really important. Now, I know my constituency in West Dublin, it's not just the cost of childcare, it's actually finding a place in a creche or childcare is a huge issue. But one thing that I can say, and I think it is something the government has seized of, something we're going to give more attention to in the future. Like Ireland is a total outlier in terms of the cost of childcare. It is really expensive. It's like another month's rent or another month's mortgage for a lot of people. So not only is it a huge cost for families, it's also now becoming a real issue economically, because
you need people at work.
And you know, for parents, particularly women, not exclusively women, but particularly women with, you know, great qualifications, a lot of talent, they're not able to get back to work as quickly as they might like to. So this is not just a huge cost for families, it's also a barrier to our economic progress. And there is things in this budget on childcare which are significant, but it's not the last word on it. I can guarantee you that. And this is an area I think you'll see government pay a lot of attention to in the next couple of years.
We've seen a lot of antisocial behaviour during the pandemic, and there is a commitment to 800 new Gardaí plus 400 new civilian staff, which should free more Gardaí to be on the beat. Are those figures, though, net of any retirements? Because a lot of Gardaí retire every year.
Yeah, that's right. So it's 800 gross, and roughly in any given year, about 350 Gardaí retire. So, you know, it's 800 plus minus the 350.
Okay.
You never know for sure in any given year how many Gardaí retire, but roughly speaking, it's 800 new recruits, and we'd anticipate about 350 retire.
So 450 will be the net added number to the force, which is significant. But the public order issues, and I mean, I know you see it in your own constituency. We see it in Dublin City Centre. What is to be done? You know, people are constantly on this programme saying, why don't you look at the Paris model? You know, there's a public order police force around every corner. They don't tolerate the gougerism that we see.
Yeah, well, you know, plenty of public order issues in Paris, I can guarantee you. And,
but generally it's the yellow vest kind of thing. But if there's any gougerism, it's dealt with swiftly.
Yeah, well, you know, I wouldn't exchange the murder rate or the violence rate in a city like Paris for Dublin or Cork any day. But this is a growing issue. I think really you're going to see two things happen. One, the additional Gardaí and the additional Garda resource will allow for a more visible presence of guards on the streets, not just foot patrols, but also bike patrols, which are being increased in the budget. But also I think, and this is going to be important, the easing of restrictions. You know, one thing in our city centres that's really missing at the moment is just footfall, people out and about, going to the office, tourists, people going out at night.
And we saw that when restaurants on the streets opened, that the gougerism rate went down. And let's hope that that process continues if we have a safe reopening. Housing for All, and we've already discussed on this programme many of the aspects of that programme. But Dermot Desmond wrote a letter to government, which I'm sure you've seen, talking about the funds having a laugh at the Irish housing policy, whereby they have these houses, they lease them to county councils, they get massive rents over a period of years, and at the end of the period of years, they still own the housing. I mean, why aren't we doing it ourselves? Because Dermot Desmond said again, what's happening at the moment from an Ireland Inc. perspective is insane.
Yeah, but it's not the true, it's not the full picture anyway. So if you take this year, about 20,000 new homes are going to be built in Ireland. Nearly half of them are being built by the state, whether it's local authorities or between a third and a half are being built by the state, whether it's local authorities or approved housing bodies funded by the state, and their builds. We do some leasing, but what's very clearly set out there in Housing for All is we're going to do less leasing over the next couple of years. Our preference is to build. If you take the long-term view, it's economically more advantageous to build and own, and that's an asset for the state.
But I mean, he says they're having a laugh at us because this is like a crazy, insane policy to actually have these funds. They don't even build them sometimes. They come in on top of a developer, buy the thing off them, and then lease to a council at a fantastic rate of return.
Yeah, well, you know, in a housing crisis, you do things that you wouldn't do in normal times. And we had very ambitious social housing targets. We went from 600 social houses a year in 2016 to 6,000 in 2019. So, you know, when you're in a crisis, you do things that you wouldn't maybe do in normal times, and we wanted to meet those targets. But leasing is not our preferred option. Leasing is being phased out. And if you look at next year, for example, there'll be over 9,000 social homes added to the housing stock. The vast majority of them will be built. There won't be leased.
Yeah, and many people complaining that in their particular neighbourhoods, I'm sure it's the same in your constituency, there's nothing to buy. Everything's for rent.
And that's why we need more supply. And, you know, one of the things that I think is encouraging over the last couple of months is new home starts. We saw in the month of July alone, over 3,000 houses went to construction. That's really encouraging. But we need more supply, not just homes to buy, homes to rent, social housing. We need to be building about 35,000 houses a year. We're not there yet, but I think we're going to get there.
Do you think the levy, and I know people argue about the comparison with the vacant site levy and now this new levy of 3%, which is less than the original thing, but you're going to map every site. So is the idea here that it'll put the skids under all these developers who are hoarding land, and at the rate of 3% per year of the value of the land, and that'll be established presumably by the councils and the mapping process, they could lose quite a lot of money if they hang on for 10 years.
Well, that's the idea. You know, I think people are getting the derelict site tax and this new tax mixed up. If you're paying 7% on a derelict site, that's going to stay at 7%. That's not going down. This is a whole new tax. This is a new tax on zoned land on the edge of our cities, for example. You know, essentially land that is zoned for development that houses could be built on, and the owner, whether it's an individual or a company, is hanging on to it. This is a very clear message. You need to get on with it. You need to get planning permission if you don't have it. If you don't have planning permission, if you do have planning permission, you need to get building. If you don't, we're coming after you with a tax. And that
why
tax
not
is
introduce
going to,
that tomorrow instead of phasing it in over a period?
We're going to do it as quickly as we can in many ways. So first of all, you need primary legislation. It's a whole new tax. you'll remember the LPT, you'll remember yep. the water charges, all that debacle. It takes a bit of time to legislate to introduce a new tax. The councils then need to produce the maps, tell people your field, your bit of land is zoned, you are going to be taxed on it. Then there needs to be time for them to appeal and say, actually, I want my land dezoned. This is my family farm. Yep. We farmed it for 300 years. We don't want to develop it. So all that's going to take about a year. So that's why the tax comes into place in 2024. But the message is very clear. And it's very clear to landowners, whether they're individuals or companies. If you have zoned land, if it's serviced, get on with it. Get planning permission, start building, build those houses. If you don't, we're coming after you with a tax. It's going to reduce your profit margins considerably, and if needs be, we'll pull it up.
Now, retrofitting the housing we've been talking about, the NDP, and I'm wondering where all the work is going to come from. Which countries? I mean, we used to have Poland, we used to have Eastern Europe. Some of those economies are doing very well. Yeah. People can get jobs in their own country. Where are we going to get the workforce to do all of this?
Well, we hope primarily from here. And Mr. Harris has a hugely ambitious apprenticeship program. We're going to recruit 10,000 apprentices a year. There's a new grant in the budget for employers to encourage employers to take apprentices on. We need more people in those professions, actually, in construction, in care, in all of those areas. So the main thing is encouraging more young people in Ireland to go for those jobs, which are very well paid jobs and really important skill jobs. Then there is the European Union. We're part of a single market. But as you say, those economies in Central Eastern Europe are doing well, and that, if you like, pipeline of labour is not going to be as good as it was in the past. And then there's the work permit system, and my department's in charge of that, and we're going to free up the work permit system.
But where are they going to live when they come here?
That's a very fair point.
Because I used to say about the Celtic Tiger that we were building houses for the people who came here to build houses.
Yeah, and in those days we built 80,000 houses a year, so I wouldn't mind if we were building half that, to be honest. But you're right, there are genuine constraints. I think the biggest problem for government over the next couple of years isn't going to be money or political will. It's going to be those constraints that are in many ways beyond our control.
Now, you said before that the pandemic, you do things you wouldn't do in normal times. And the PUP and the wage subsidy scheme were exceptional measures for which a lot of people are very grateful. But they're being phased out sequentially. PUP, first of all, and then the wage subsidy scheme eventually. I think it's April is going to go.
Yeah.
Should this not have happened earlier? Because we know there are shortages in hospitality, shortages in construction, and there is a suspicion that some people are gaming the system as well. But, you know, people lying in bed on the PUP when they might have been working in a coffee shop or a restaurant.
Well, I suppose it's a judgment call, to be honest. At its peak, there were 650,000 people in receipt of the pandemic unemployment payment. It's now under 100,000. So, you know, 5 out of 6 went back to work almost as soon as they could. And a lot of those who haven't gone back to work yet, they are in those sectors that aren't fully open yet. So, you know, we took a view that the economy, all things going to plan, will be fully reopened on the 22nd of October. Yeah. And we thought we'd give people maybe 6 to 8 weeks after that to get back to work. And I think that's reasonable.
Now, you've anticipated my next area of questioning, which is about October 22nd. Mm. The numbers are worrying. A fear this might be Christmas 2020 all over again. The Midland Hospital closed to visitors. A report of someone as young as 17 in ICU. The numbers every day not coming down. Numbers in ICU, numbers in hospital going up. And you're wondering, why are we lifting all restrictions on the 22nd?
Well, the numbers are worrying. The Delta wave didn't turn out to be as severe as we feared. If you look at the 4 models that NEFA put forward, we did better than the optimistic model. So the Delta wave didn't turn out to be as bad as we thought it would be. But we've never managed to really get numbers down in Ireland. And, you know, that is a question that we talk about and ask ourselves about in government all the time. You know, the Delta wave swept across Europe, went from west to east. And you see countries now in Central Europe that are now yellow zones or green zones, and we're still a red zone. Our incidence is still very high in Ireland.
And do you have any understanding why that be? Is because I remember the Taoiseach saying at one point, we're going to go on data, not dates. But we are going on a date this time. It's the 22nd of October. And I'm wondering, where's the science that says it's safe to open on the 22nd?
Well, you know, there is going to be an effort meeting early next week, and we'll have to see what the outcome of that meeting is and what their advice is. There's lots of theories as to why the incidence in Ireland has remained very high. Nobody knows for sure. But, you know, I think one thing we can say is that notwithstanding the enormous reopening that has happened, you know, schools back, colleges back, people going back to work, most of the economy fully reopened, we haven't seen numbers go up much or take off much. They've been pretty stable at around, you know, 13, 14, 1500 a day, but stable at a high level, and that is a cause for concern.
This is a pandemic in the United States and in Europe of the unvaccinated.
Yeah.
The vaccine bonus we were promised, I mean, the only vaccine bonus that will remain after the 22nd, if everything goes according to plan, is the ability to fly if you've got a vaccine cert or if you get a PCR test or an antigen test. And the people who chose not to get vaccinated, who, you know, put the rest of us in harm's way, they get a bonus. They can go to any restaurant, any theatre, any cinema without let or hindrance. And they'll be looking at the rest of us saying, weren't you the eejits now to get vaccinated?
Well, first of all, like what you say is correct. It is now a pandemic of the unvaccinated. That wasn't the case, obviously, before the vaccines. The vaccines are safe and enormously effective. There are about 75 people in ICU today. 50 of those are not fully vaccinated. So if everyone was fully vaccinated, there'd only be 25 in ICU. Like that, that's the difference the vaccines are making. And just that 8%, that 8%.
So why should those people be rewarded? I mean, there is still a great pool of people who are potentially to be infected by COVID, which will find you if you're vulnerable, because we've 3.5 million fully vaccinated people or thereabouts. Population is 5 million. That means there's 1.5 million. Many of them, of course, under 12, because they haven't got the go ahead to be vaccinated yet. But there's 1.5 million of people who are a potential well of infection. So why should we not restrict the unvaccinated from certain activities and give the bonus to the people who did what the government asked and got vaccinated?
Yeah, but like, isn't that what we're doing? So
no, but after the 22nd, anyone can go into any restaurant, mix with who knows who, who's beside you, unvaccinated. Why should that be?
Well, you know, that's something we're going to have to consider next week. You know, the plan is to lift pretty much all legal restrictions on the 22nd of October to remove the vaccine pass from restaurants, for example. But, you know, that is something we're going to have to consider now next week, depending on where we stand with the numbers and what the advice from NPHET is. You know, I'm very keen that we should go ahead with the full reopening on October 22nd. I want to see the restrictions on hospitality end. I'd like to see full stadiums, nightclubs open. But we do have that issue. Yeah, you're
so
right,
that's not a given yet. I mean, some people have characterised so-called Freedom Day as free-for-all day, but that's not necessarily going to be the case.
And I have to say Freedom Day is never a term that's been used by the Irish government. We've always talked
For shorthand.
We've always talked about the new normal. No, the plan is to go ahead and ease most of the remaining legal restrictions on the 22nd of October, but that will depend on the numbers over the next couple of days. It will depend on the advice from NPHET. And, you know, I can't rule out the possibility that we may reopen but still retain some restrictions.
Now, a number of other issues. Currently today, of course, we have the announcement by the EU of how it would propose to ease the problems of the Northern Ireland Protocol. But then you have Lord David Frost shooting everything down on the basis of the European Court of Justice. You're quoted yesterday saying, hang on a second, that's just, we can't concede that, because we have to rule the single market using the European Court of Justice. That's the only mechanism. He knows that, you know that, the EU knows that, so what are they at?
Well, you know, I don't know, and I'm no longer at the centre of the Brexit issue, but I'd love to find out. And, you know, I have to say, I know Dominic Cummings doesn't speak for the British government, but, you know, his comments in the last couple of days suggesting that the British government never plans to honour the agreement is very alarming.
How can you deal with people like that if their intent going in and signing a document was not to abide by the terms of that document? I mean, that just makes them untrustworthy on every level.
Well, you know, it shouldn't just be alarming for us here in Ireland or in the European Union. It should be alarming for everyone around the world, for any country that's thinking of making a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom, for any country that's thinking of signing an agreement with the UK, for any business even that's investing in the UK. If it's no longer the case that British people honour their word, well, you know, then you need to be pretty sceptical about anything that they might agree to. And you know, if I was a leader of a non-European country now and I was thinking of negotiating an agreement with the UK, I'd pause that, actually, and I'd say, let's see how this pans out with the European Union and the protocol, because if they can't honour agreements with their nearest neighbour, they're not going to honour an agreement with me.
It's extraordinary what's going on, because North-South trade is thriving. You know, the dividend that Northern Ireland was going to get from the single market has worked. Now, there are empty shelves in mainland UK, so any empty shelves in Northern Ireland are not different necessarily from empty shelves over there, but they are stocking their shelves from the Republic, which is great. So what, is there something else going on? I mean, are they looking at maybe the jig is up for Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom, that's part of their fear?
I don't know if that's the case, but if you take the protocol, it was designed to do a few things. First of all, it was designed to avoid a hard border between North and South.
Success.
It's been a success. North-South trade is booming, as you say, in both directions, so it's strengthened the all-island economy. It was designed to protect the single market and our position in it. That's been a success. It was also designed to allow Northern Ireland to trade freely both with Britain and the European single market. And that's where there are real difficulties. You know, there are checks and controls. There are problems getting goods from Britain into Northern Ireland. We acknowledge that. We understand that's a problem for Northern Ireland business. We understand that's particularly a problem for the unionist community. We want to work on that. And you'll see...
today, there's going to be four documents which are going to help. But they've shut them down.
And they're very far-reaching. And, you know, it's you know, I certainly feel that Ireland and the European Union really have made a huge effort to make the protocol work, to make concessions. And it does seem that every time we do, the British government banks those concessions and says it's not enough. And it's making them very hard to work with. And, you know, I would certainly say to people in Northern Ireland and politicians in Northern Ireland, you know, you feel the British government let you down before, don't think they won't do it to you again.
And we will be playing Dominic Cummings' comments later on in the programme. A few other things. The methane agreement in Paris this week, you know, I'm not across the detail of it, but it looks like huge cuts in methane production. Our biggest methane producers, of course, are the cattle, the national herd. John Fitzgerald, eminent professor, suggesting we have to cull the national herd. Not tomorrow, but that's where we're going. That's a thorny one for a COP in Glasgow, isn't it, for us?
And it's not the policy of government. You know, we're an island of 5 million people. We produce enough food to feed 50 million people. You know, I'm proud of the fact that I live in a country where we export 9 times as much food as we consume, that we're able to provide food for a hungry world where demand for food is going to increase. And what we're trying to do, and it is a challenge, is to reduce our emissions from agriculture without reducing food production. Because if we reduce food production, it'll just be displaced to other parts of the world where environmental standards and labour standards
might be lower. Can we make more noise about that? The idea of clearing the Amazonian rainforest to breed cattle to sell meat to Europe, when we've already centuries ago cleared our forests and have pasture land to produce, you know, grass-fed cattle. I mean, it's a pretty wonderful way, if you're going to produce cattle, to do it, not in sheds, not with pellets, but with grass. Can we not make more noise about that and get credit for it?
I think we should. There's a concept in climate science called carbon leakage, and that's essentially where you shut something down in one country, say steel production, for example, or burning coal, if you like, in your power plants, and you then end up just importing it from somewhere else, and that achieves nothing because it's the one atmosphere, it's the one environment. If you displace emissions from your country to another country, you actually achieve nothing. And one of the things we're working on, for example, at a European level, is what they call the carbon border adjustment mechanism, which is, if you like, a new tax that will be brought in to prevent products being brought into the European Union that were produced with lower environmental standards than ours. And I think you're going to hear a lot more conversation about that, because it's, you know, it's very easy for us to do the right thing and shut down industries that produce emissions in Ireland, only to displace them somewhere else. Like that achieves
that
nothing.
Doesn't make sense.
It's the one environment. It's the one atmosphere.
A few quick things. People talking about blended working, which they want. Many people do, and yet the traffic levels around the capital are pretty high. Don't know where we're going with that. I mean, there are some small tax incentives to work at home, but that whole business of carbon as well. Let people stay at home. Are we going to develop a more specific policy on this?
Well, first of all, like in the budget yesterday, we trebled the existing tax incentive for remote working. So if you're working from home, your employer can give you a per diem of $320 a day to help with the bills. Or from next year, you can claim 30% of your utility bills against tax. So you know it's
okay,
it's,
but
it's
will there be a more developed policy on blended work? Perhaps it's for another day.
The next thing that comes in, and I'm doing this legislation in the new year, is the right to request remote working. So if it's possible for you to work from home, you'll have a legal right to go to your employer, say I want to work from home, and your employer will either have to say yes or no. If they say no, they'll have to give you a good reason, and that reason can be challenged.
Okay, a couple of final things then. Owen Keegan telling the students union to go build apartments.
Yeah, I have to he shouldn't have written that letter. Quite frankly, I don't want to slag him off because he's a capable manager and he's done some very good things. But
ill judged.
When I saw that letter, I thought it was Waterford Whispers. To be honest, I didn't really think he actually wrote that letter and signed it. I thought it was kind of insulting, actually.
Okay.
And I think you should withdraw
that. We're going to be late going into the news, but I just want to ask you a couple more things. The new bank holiday decision day, is it going to be before Christmas and will it start this year?
Not decided yet. We decided to park consideration of that matter until the budget was done. The budget is done. We now turn our attention to other burning issues, MiCA, climate, and what we can do in terms of that pandemic. I don't the word bonus, but we do want to do something to remember those who died in the pandemic and recognise those who helped us get through it. And these are now all decisions for government over the next couple of weeks.
All right. And the final thing about NPHET, I mean, is the government saying that potentially, this is clarification for our listeners, that October the 22nd might not be totally restriction-free?
Well, the plan is to go ahead as planned on the 22nd of October, which is the lifting of all legal restrictions, with the exception of a few things. We'll still be saying that people have to wear masks in retail, in healthcare and on public transport. But as has always been the case, that will depend on a government decision to be made next week. We're looking at the date at the moment. There'll be an NPHET meeting. There will be advice which government will consider.
Will it be published, that advice? Because you remember last Christmas, you did two things simultaneously, opening up hospitality and schools, and NPHET only said do one or the other.
Well, the advice will be published, and it always is, and published quite quickly, and that's been the right approach. Looking at the numbers, though, and it does depend over the next couple of days, you know, the numbers have increased and that is a matter of concern. Number of cases have gone up, also hospitalizations and ICU, but it does seem to be relatively stable. But like I say, we'll make that decision for DEFIN next week. Well,
let's hope we follow the science, whatever that, wherever that leads us, because that's the mantra of this program. Tánaiste de Leo Varadkar, thank you very much for joining us.
Unfortunately, the science changes, but we follow
it evolves. It evolves. Science never sleeps, as Luke O'Neill always says. Tánaiste, thank you very much for joining us.